Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're talking about a question that anyone who's ever seen a knight in full armor has probably asked themselves.
Namely, how do you actually get into one of those? And more importantly, how long does it take?
Because it's not exactly like a jacket you just throw on.
Definitely not. We're talking about a process that, even with an experienced helper, the squire, took an estimated 15 to 30 minutes. With a Gothic full plate armor, that's over 200 individual pieces. So practice and proper fit were essential.
Half an hour just to get dressed.
Just to get dressed. And that's with someone who knows exactly what they're doing. Doing it alone would have been extremely tedious and taken much longer. A helper was practically indispensable.
That also explains why the squire was so important. He wasn't just a servant. He was essentially a personal trainer and dresser all in one.
Even more than that, the squire was often a young nobleman himself, on his way to becoming a knight. Putting on the armor was part of his training. He had to understand how every single piece worked before he was allowed to wear it himself.
So, learning by doing in the truest sense.
And it all starts with the basics.
The gambeson.
You wanted to grab that one, didn't you?
I have one myself, so I'm naturally biased. The gambeson is this padded jacket worn under the armor. And it's substantial, let's say.
In what way?
With combat gambesons, we're talking about multiple layers of linen fabric, quilted, sometimes filled with raw wool or fabric scraps. Under plate armor, they were rather thin, about 2 to 4 kilos. But standalone textile armor, so-called akitons, could weigh 5 to 8 kilos.
That's almost like training with a weighted vest.
And it keeps you incredibly warm. After an hour in a gambeson, you understand why the shirt and doublet underneath
were completely soaked in sweat.
There's this lovely understated phrase, covered with sweat and grime from previous use.
These garments were custom made and precious. They weren't washed after every use. On top of that came stockings and, very importantly, a coif.
That's often forgotten, isn't it?
Totally underestimated, but it was crucial. Imagine putting on a tight metal helmet
and your hair gets caught. Ouch.
It pulls, it hurts, it's distracting. In combat, a distraction like that could be fatal.
That's what fascinates me about this whole subject. Every little detail had a practical purpose. Nothing was decorative.
If I had to compare to something modern, maybe motorsports? Putting on the complete protective gear there also takes its time.
Except a Formula One driver doesn't expect to be attacked with a lance.
Hopefully not. But the basic idea is similar. Maximum protection with maximum mobility. And that requires preparation.
And someone to help you with it. In the Middle Ages, the squire. Today, the technical team.
The big difference is...
Was it about the personal bond?
You're reading my mind.
The squire often spent years with his knight. He knew every strap, every buckle, every quirk of the armor.
A true confidant.
He had to be. Your life depended on every piece fitting perfectly. One buckle too loose, one strap twisted. In a real fight, that could have fatal consequences.
Now it gets specific. After the gambeson, the legs come first.
That surprises many people. You'd intuitively think you start at the top, maybe with a helmet.
Logical thinking, but completely impractical. Imagine already having the heavy breastplate on and then having to bend down to put on greaves.
That would be like tying your shoes while wearing a life jacket.
Pretty much. That's where you work from bottom to top. First the greaves, then the crease, then the torso.
What does it actually feel like standing in full leg armor?
Surprisingly good, if it fits properly. The weight distributes across the entire leg, not like a block, but evenly. The trick is, the pieces are asymmetrically shaped.
A detail that's easy to overlook. You quickly assume armor is simply identical on both sides.
That would have been easier to produce. But the smiths back then studied anatomy carefully. The greave for the calf, for example, it's curved differently on the inside than on the outside.
Oh, because the calf muscle...
Because the muscle itself isn't symmetrical. It's shaped differently on the inside than outside. The armor has to account for that, otherwise it chafes and pinches.
Or you can't move properly.
And mobility was vital for survival. The creases were even more complex. They had to move with you when walking, adjust when riding, and protect you at the same time. And that brings us to a detail I find truly ingenious. The so-called median ridge, often called a stop rib in the community, particularly pronounced on Gothic armor.
That sounds quite technical at first.
But it's brutally practical. On the crease, there's a small ridge, a raised edge. It prevents a sword strike from sliding up along the thigh.
Into sensitive areas.
Into very sensitive areas. An armor expert once described how this exact stop rib saved his, let's say, his family planning in actual combat.
That's a pretty convincing argument.
A very direct one. Without that little ridge, the sword blow would have simply continued upward.
You really don't want to imagine that.
It shows once again, the armourers thought about such details. Every edge, every curve was functional.
True engineering work.
Same with the fastenings. There were...
straps, loops, buckles?
All of the above. The greaves were secured with leather straps. The cuisses laced to a special arming doublet, a thin doublet worn under the thick gambeson. Some systems used buckles, others hooks. It varied by region and century.
The system had to accomplish two things simultaneously. Stay secure while still allowing movement.
With every step, every lunge, when mounting a horse, the attachment points were strategically chosen. Not too tight, or it cuts off blood flow. Not too loose, or everything shifts at the critical moment.
Basically like modern sports equipment. Shin guards in football are also
secured with straps and Velcro. But the difference is the weight.
How heavy was leg armor like that?
About 3 kilos per leg. Gothic leg armor was slightly heavier than Milanese. Sounds like a lot, but when it's well distributed, it's surprisingly comfortable to wear. The weight wasn't concentrated in one spot, but spread across the calf, knee, and thigh.
Still, a whole day in the field.
You'd be completely exhausted. Not from the weight alone, but from the constant tension. Every movement requires coordination.
No wonder knights needed their squires to help them out of it in the evening.
And back into it in the morning. A real full-service job. Now comes the torso, the heart of the entire armor.
And this is where it gets really complex. We have multiple layers working together. Gambeson, mail, breastplate, backplate, and all of it has to fit properly.
Wait, chainmail and plate armor? That sounds redundant.
At first glance, yes. But the plate had a problem. It couldn't be everywhere. At the joints, in the armpits, the crook of the arm, the neck, the groin area. You need freedom of movement there.
and those exact gaps were covered with mail.
The mail was the second line of defense. If a thrust came through a gap in the plate, it still had to get through the mail.
So a redundant system, like modern safety technology, multiple layers.
The breastplate itself protected the chest and ribs. The backplate protected the spine. Both were connected over the shoulders and...
How heavy was that altogether?
The complete armor? About 20 to 30 kilos. Sounds brutal at first.
That's like a fully packed hiking backpack.
That comparison actually works quite well. The secret was the distribution. The weight sat close to the body center of gravity. The hips and shoulders bore the main load. Nothing dangled from the extremities.
That's why knights in full armor could fight, fall, get back up.
The image of the knight lying on his back like a beetle, unable to get up, that's a myth. At least for standard field armor.
Tournament armor was different?
So-called jousting armor could weigh 40, 50 kilos. Extreme German examples, even up to 70, 80 kilos. But those weren't meant for hours of battle, just short, controlled competitions.
Below the breastplate came the fold that protected the lower abdomen, and the tassets hung from that.
The tassets are interesting. They were adjustable, depending on whether you were fighting on foot or...
on horseback.
In the saddle, you need different freedom of movement than in foot combat. The tassets could be adjusted accordingly.
And the arms? They were constantly in motion.
With arm protection, it gets really...
because the armor was asymmetrical?
Exactly. The right and left arm were often armored asymmetrically. For example, reinforced shoulder protection on the left. But the basic form was similar.
Because they had different chops.
The sword arm, usually the right, needed maximum mobility. Striking, parrying, following through. The armor there was lighter, more flexible. The shield arm, on the other hand, was the passive bulwark.
That one had to take hits, not deal them.
So more plate, thicker material. The arm pieces, by the way, were connected with internal leathers and sliding or hinge rivets. Flexible, not rigidly bolted. Every joint could move.
Vam braces, elbow protection.
And the elbow cup with its wings. Plus a mail voider for the crook of the arm itself. A solid plate there would have completely blocked movement. That was particularly important. Arteries and tendons run there.
A hit there would be... critical.
Fatal if you're unlucky. Hence the extra protection. And then the shoulders. On tournament armor, they even had two layers of armor.
Two?
One layer over another. That was mainly found on tournament armor. Grand guards and reinforcements that were mounted on top of the standard field harness, specifically designed against lance attacks. When you ride toward each other at a gallop, the lance usually hits...
the shoulder.
Or the upper chest area. The double armor there was meant to distribute the impact and make penetration more difficult.
They really thought of everything.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to BattleMerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
They had to. Every weak point was a potential death sentence. The armorers weren't simple craftsmen. They were engineers, the best of their time.
And the knight's fate depended on their work.
Every single day. A poorly fitting shoulder piece, a strap too loose at the elbow, in a rear fight, that could make all the difference.
The helmet was the centerpiece. One of the most expensive. The breastplate was pricier, but the most important and most personal piece of the entire armor.
Because it had to be the most individually fitted?
That too, but mainly because it decided life and death like no other piece. A hit to the head without a helmet,
That was it.
There were different types. Basquinet, Greatham, Hounskerr.
And each had its pros and cons. The big question was always, visor or no visor? That was a tactical decision every fighter had to make for himself.
Maximum protection versus maximum awareness.
A lowered visor protects the face completely. But you see, like through a mail slot, the field of vision is massively restricted, and hearing even more so.
You mainly hear your own breathing. Everything else is muffled.
In a tournament, that was acceptable. You know where your opponent is. You ride straight toward each other. But on the battlefield?
Attacks come from all directions.
And you need to hear and see them before they hit you. Many experienced fighters deliberately left their visors open, despite the risk.
The trade-off? Possibly taking an arrow to the face, or definitely not noticing someone coming from your left.
Some helmets had no visor at all. They offered better vision, better hearing, and were often lighter.
But less protection.
Always a compromise. What every helmet had in common, it had to fit perfectly. The fit was just as critical as with...
As with every other component. A helmet that pinches or wobbles is distracting. And distraction in combat...
decides everything. Not even through a direct hit, but because one careless moment could be your last.
Which brings us to a grim topic.
The reality was...
that even the smallest injuries could have fatal consequences.
Not the wound itself, but what came after.
Infections. Medieval battlefields were... well, imagine. Horses, people, mud... blood, no disinfectant, no antibiotics. A scratch that got infected could be fatal within 3 days.
That's why protection was so important. Not just against a big, visible hit.
But against every little injury, no matter how small.
Which brings us to the lance rest. That little detail on the breastplate that's often overlooked.
The hook on the right side?
The rest, where the lance sits. It wasn't just there for stabilization. It transfers all the force to the body.
How so?
Without a rest, you have to hold the lance with pure arm strength. In a collision at full gallop, it rips the weapon right out of your hand.
With a rest, the energy of the impact transfers to the entire body.
Your entire body weight plus the speed of the horse, all concentrated on the lance tip. That was the force that shattered shields and pierced armor.
A small piece of metal that makes all the difference.
With every detail, the armorers ask themselves, how can we give the wearer an advantage? And how do we keep him alive?
When you put it all together, the 15 to 30 minutes of dressing, the dozens of individual pieces, the perfect coordination between them.
It becomes clear why this was more than just protective clothing.
It was a system. Every piece interlocked with the others. Everything had to work together.
And that's what's special about authentic armor to this day. When you actually wear something like that, and I mean really wear it, not just look at it, you suddenly understand things you could never learn from books.
How weight distributes, how movement works, why certain combat techniques developed.
It's a journey through time. Sounds dramatic, but it's accurate.
It isn't, though. When you stand in armor from the 15th century, you're wearing the same thing as someone over 500 years ago. The same limitations, the same advantages.
You breathe differently. You move differently. You think
differently about the people who wore this every day.
And about the craftsmen who created it. The armorers who thought through every curve, every ridge, every connection.
Without computers, without modern tools, with experience, skill, and the knowledge that a mistake could cost someone their life.
That's the respect you develop. Not just for the knights, but for the entire system behind them. The squires, the smiths, the leather workers.
So, if you're now keen to experience this for yourself,
or dive deeper into the subject first,
at bettermerchant.com you find not only armor and equipment, but also plenty more articles on the blog. History you can touch, so to speak.
And who knows? Maybe you'll soon be standing in a gambeson yourself and understanding why those things are so substantial.
That's all for today. Thanks for listening.
Until next time, and stay curious about history.
Bye.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.